on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
So, yeah, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of chaos. This is nature's way of telling us, humans, you're going to have to make a leap in consciousness, in insight. It's time. It's happened before in history. It's time. It's not going to be comfortable. It's not going to be rational. We're not going to be able to predict where we're going. One of the key elements of quantum theory is the uncertainty principle. Without uncertainty, let me ask this question. If everything was certain, there'd be no interesting art, no interesting music, no interesting philosophy. Part of the reason we are who we are is because of our need to deal with uncertainty. Without the false comfort of thinking everything's now certain.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I'm joined by author Douglas Grunther to discuss his new book, The Quantum and the Dream, Visionary Consciousness, AI, and the New Renaissance. In this wide-ranging conversation, Douglas delves into philosophy, depth psychology, quantum theory, human consciousness, transcending the materialist paradigm, and how committed individuals can drive positive change and usher in a new era of collaboration and ecological consciousness. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Douglas Grunther is the creator host of the Woodstock Roundtable, a rollicking and multi-award-winning radio talk show spiced with humor and informed by his love of philosophy, depth psychology, and spiritual insight. His guests have been among the most original visionaries of our time. Grunther graduated from Columbia University, where he was a Rhodes Scholarship finalist. He has been the featured speaker in front of national audiences and is a DreamWork facilitator certified by Dr. Jeremy Taylor, co-founder of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. He joins me today to discuss his book, The Quantum in the Dream, Visionary Consciousness, AI, and the New Renaissance. Doug, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Great to be with you, Nicholas. Appreciate being on.
Well, I am very happy to have you on. I think in many ways we are, just reading your book, I think we're kind of kindred spirits. There's a lot that I have done in my own academic journey and interests that I've had that I found expressed in your book. So I'm hoping that this will be a really good conversation. I was curious, I thought that maybe the way to start, and please forgive me, and I'll ask the audience to forgive me, the coffee's still kicking in. I thought that what I would do is maybe try to, in a very short statement, say what the thesis of your book is, kind of the main argument, and we'll go from there because I'm sure there's going to be room for you to correct me. So you begin in the turn of the 20th century with the Freud's publication of An Interpretation of Dreams, 1900. And at the same year, you had Max Planck develop quantum theory. And so you suggest that this is a kind of synchronicity. And both of those have the properties of going deep, going in. And so this marked a shift in human consciousness. And what you seem to be arguing is that this precipitates this kind of change of consciousness. And I don't know if that's the best way of saying that. Through also our media, you bring in Marshall McLuhan, which I have some things to talk to you about that, to our computer age, and especially the development of AI. So all of this is a journey towards what you see as a new renaissance. And also, our understanding of nature, our changing understanding of material reality, but also nature as systems that work together. Do I have it about right?
That was as good, if not better, than I could do. But it's interesting. I just want to back up a little bit. Any author who's honest knows that what we put out there is not always everything we intended, and that we count on people who read it and engage with it to find things in it that I may have been unconscious of. So I don't pretend that I know everything about the book I read. That's the beautiful thing about depth and depth psychology. What someone listening or watching as you were giving that big picture view of my book might say, how the heck, I'm being polite, can you take those huge themes and find a common theme among them? And you correctly stated that it's about the process of going deeper within, because my book is not a celebration of Freud's interpretation of the unconscious. It celebrates Freud as he ought to be, as someone who was one of the most significant change shifters of the 20th century. That's not an opinion, that's a fact. Much of what Freud talked about is no longer discussed, and he's kind of been pushed down a number of pegs from where he was, understandably. And I speak briefly about that in my book. But he deserves all the credit for not for discovering the unconscious. The unconscious was discussed throughout the 19th century, primarily among certain philosophers and the romantic poets, et cetera. But Freud was the first person who said, the unconscious is so important, we actually need to create a whole science around it and a whole psychology around it. As I point out, Carl Jung, who started at the side of Freud, expanded magnificently Freud's understanding of the unconscious. But Freud deserves the credit for initiating that lookward in the first year of the modern age. I think we could agree that the year 1900 was the historical shift from the Victorian age into the more modern age. And as you point out, and no one else has really seen this as a connection, that same year, the first year of the modern age, Max Planck discovers the quantum. He wasn't intending to discover it. He discovered it by accident. And it was so mysterious that he kind of buried it. He didn't want to talk about it too much. It was Einstein who picked up the gauntlet. But then how do we take that phenomenon in the year 1900 and connect it to AI and the era we're living in right now? And the answer is the materialist paradigm. And I am not the first. I am not the most prominent person with a background in philosophy, psychology, and media who has talked about the crucial need for humanity to transcend the materialist paradigm. That's what connects all this. And that's what I think, I'm guessing, and induced you to say that we're kind of kindred spirits based on your work and mine. So I would suggest we talk a little bit about what this materialist paradigm is and why it needs to be transcended, because that gets to the heart of what my book is about. The materialist paradigm has been with us for hundreds of years, and it's been a huge success in terms of giving us magnificent technology. It helped induce the Industrial Revolution. If it did nothing other than help create the discovery of antibiotics, that would almost be enough, because since the discovery of antibiotics in the 1920s, we've increased human lifespan. We've almost doubled it within 100 years. We have amazing technologies, such as the one you and I are talking on right now, the World Wide Web. And so we have a lot to be thankful for all the material advantages that we have versus 100, 200, 300 years ago. But now that very advantage is literally the seeds of our potential destruction, because the very materialist paradigm, which got us to think about that the value of being a human being is to get from nature everything we can, to pull out of nature all the material goods and rewards and comforts that we can, with 8 billion of us and counting trying to do that, we're literally eroding the very environment that keeps us alive. And so the materialist paradigm basically says, views the world and nature as a series of concrete material objects to be manipulated and grabbed for in order for us to not only survive, but to create the good life. And it's no longer working. It's literally destroying the environment that we need to live on. And what makes it really important, we're not just destroying it for ourselves, but for all, for the majority of living creatures who depend on it. And so there are a number of visionary thinkers who I talk about in my book, and I know you would be familiar with many of them, like McLuhan. Visionary thinkers who, since the year 1900, have been calling for a transition from this materialist paradigm, where we see nature as an object for us to grab at for our satisfaction, to an understanding, a paradigm that says, wait a minute, we're not apart from nature. We are embedded in it. We were born from nature's intelligence. We call it evolution. And we are part of this vast, incredibly interconnected network that includes us, all the animals, but also the oceans, the rivers, the streams, the air that provides life on this planet is all an interconnected system. And you can't just pick and choose and grab for things and expect this system to work. And so some of the people that I celebrate in my book, Carl Jung, Albert Einstein, Niels Bohr, the father of quantum theory, Marshall McLuhan, the great mythologist, having a senior moment. Joseph Campbell, the great cultural historian, William Irwin Thompson, who I had the pleasure of interviewing. Not a well-known name, but a guy who literally helped change the vision of the 70s and 80s with his work with Lindisfarne. People like Lynn Margulis, who should be better known as the Angry Earth Mother, because she wouldn't take crap from anybody, and helped us understand a deeper relationship to evolution than even Darwin could provide. She celebrated Darwin as opening the door, but she took it further, and she's been proven to be right. And so the kind of strange attractor, the connecting element of the quantum and the dream is the need to get past this materialist paradigm if humanity is not only going to survive, but thrive as we move towards this incredible digital age we live in.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree with that. I'm usually criticizing the materialist paradigm. Some people know that. And where I put everything is on consciousness anyway, because I think that the materialist paradigm still doesn't have an answer for it. And it seems that if we start digging into what exactly is consciousness, that opens up so many different avenues. And it seems to me, and this is consistent with what you're writing, that there is a turn towards Eastern philosophies and spiritualities, because they have been exploring consciousness way longer than we have. And as well, the idea that it's not just humans that are conscious, that there seems to be, you know, it's consciousness seems to pervade everything in a way.
But, well, let's go back to the materialist paradigm. The majority of scientists, philosophers, and psychologists, most of them are still, I would say, stuck in the materialist paradigm. Here's a perfect example. As you point out, the subject of consciousness has become a hot topic. There are many books published every year on the topic of consciousness, and some of the brightest people on the planet are having at it. What I find sometimes frustrating, sometimes I just have to smile, is that as brilliant as these people are who are talking about consciousness, they're still convinced that they're going to find it in the brain.
Right.
And when it's pointed out that we've had for decades, thanks to quantum physics, EEG and MRI machines, which can literally view the human brain as it's going through activities. And when it's pointed out that they haven't found one instant, they haven't found one element of physical consciousness in the physical brain, they say, well, just give us more time. Fair enough. But there is a growing minority of scientists, philosophers, psychologists who are more tuned into the kind of paradigm that you point out, the ancient Eastern mystics and the Kabbalists and the Gnostics and the Celtic spiritual people have been tuning in for millennia, that consciousness pervades the universe. consciousness is more like a field, just like gravity is a field. Electromagnetism is a field that produces light. That consciousness is a field within which we operate. That changes the whole game because it, again, it says you can't understand what it means to be a human being in the 21st century with simply with the materialist paradigm.
Right.
We've reached the limit of what that can give us, and it's given us a lot, but it's reached its limit. And if we don't transcend to a more pervasive, we'll get into left hemisphere, right hemisphere, intuitive, non-material, imaginative vision of who we are and how we connect to nature and each other. In the age of the World Wide Web, when 5.5 billion of us and counting are connected, our brains are literally connected. That's creating a lot of chaos, but it also creates the seeds of a potential for a true collaboration on a scale never seen before. And as a punchline, the most popular historian on the planet, and I think he deserves to be, Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote Sapiens, pointed out the reason we human beings are the most powerful and intelligent creatures on this planet is because of our ability to collaborate with each other.
Yeah.
And you and I are talking over the most collaborative medium ever invented. Marshall McLuhan, who we'll talk about, pointed out accurately every new medium requires time for us to adjust to it. It literally rewires the human brain. We can now see this happening with EEG and MRI machines. And so it takes time to adjust. And we have less time to adjust now in the 21st century because the key difference between where we are, Nicholas, and where our even two generations ago were, is the speed of change is exponentially faster than ever before. So we are being called upon by evolution, nature's intelligence, to adjust to the speed of change. At the same time, we need to get off the digital screen, slow down our brain waves, and do more contemplation and meditation. So we're in this incredibly paradoxical situation where we need to both speed up our brains to keep up with the advantages of the digital age and get off the screen and slow down our brains to do what visionaries and contemplative people have been doing for millennia, which is to use insight into our, you know, the inner game,
right?
Pointing the telescope inward by slowing our brain waves down and getting a bigger picture of who we are, not just who we think we are or who advertisers, politicians, and power players are telling us who we are. We're going to have to figure out together and on our own a deeper sense of who we are and how we connect to nature.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And one of the things my master's thesis is I looked at the computer revolution and used Marshall McLuhan as sort of my theoretical backbone of it. And I essentially asked the question of looking at his theories of, you know, the electronic media as it emerged in the 50s and 60s and whatnot. It's like, well, how is this going to affect human consciousness with computers and as we become more interconnected? And I'll just throw this out there. It's because of my reading of McLuhan that I ended up defining consciousness as the medium of being.
That's very good. I think he would like that.
Yeah. I don't know if it's right or not, but it seems to make sense to me. But, you know, one of the concerns that I've had doing the research I did, and I know that with McLuhan, there was this idea, there was all this excitement about the internet when it first, you know, kind of became popular in the 90s and was made available to people, that it could be used as, you know, organizing tools and things like that. And it has been, but there's also this sort of shadow side to it. And it seems to me that that's where we need to return to depth psychology, because you noted, I think, at one point in the book that not only is this media and the content of the media part of our consciousness, but it's also the unconscious. There's all this unconscious material out there. And it seems like we're being forced very quickly, as you said, to finally start going in and not just in contemplation, but in healing and seeing what is kind of, I guess, what's wrong, you know, or what's damaged, what's ill with the human psyche. Because I always hold that what we see outside is a reflection of what's inside.
Well, I agree with that. And as a big metaphor, and you kind of got to this in your opening about my book. So here's a metaphor. I spent time comparing where we are to where our ancestors were at the beginning of the Italian Renaissance, because I'm proposing that there's a good chance we are headed towards a new Renaissance. Okay. Well, number one, and I think this gets to your point about the unconscious. During the Italian Renaissance, one of the great inducers was the fact that the Black Plague was on its way to killing a third of Europe. Now, it's hard for us to get our heads wrapped around that, because when we were taught about the Italian Renaissance, we learned about the Statue of David and the Sistine Chapel and Galileo, you know, discovering the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, all of which were crucial. But it was happening at a time when people were dying of this horrific plague, and they didn't know the cause. And very few people during the Italian Renaissance were literate. And yet they produced the Renaissance. Okay. So here we are in the 21st century in an age of anxiety, of climate change, which is a polite way of saying we're literally eroding the very environment that keeps us alive. I don't have to convince anyone regardless of where you are politically, that we're at a point where the two political parties can't even talk to each other. McLuhan famously said that when things change dramatically, it's an implosion. Okay. Nature is brilliant, but it's not always kindly. The Italian Renaissance was a magnificent period of human of an evolutionary leap. Okay. But it was done within the context of a black plague that was on its way to killing one third of every human being on the continent of Europe, rich and poor alike. And no one knew the cause. Okay. So I see climate change, which is already wreaking havoc around the world and is accelerating at a pace even the supercomputers can't keep pace with, as analogous to what our ancestors had to go through with the Black Plague. The difference is we know the cause. Not everyone's willing to admit it. Some people remain blissfully blind to it, but enough of us know the cause. So we have a huge advantage there. What McLuhan pointed out, I thought this was one of his most provocative insights. And when I first read it, it was 55, you know, 53 years ago when I was in college, I went, you know, it sounds like he's onto something, but it doesn't really make sense to me. When he said, okay, all new media are extensions of the human body. Now we can understand the wheel's an extension of the foot. We can understand the clothes are an extension of our skin. And we can understand, going back to the Italian Renaissance, that the telescope Galileo used to prove the Earth was not the center of the universe, it was an extension of the human eye. but what McLuhan said was electronic technology, starting with the telegraph and growing exponentially to what you and I are talking on now, is an extension of the human nervous system. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. What is the human nervous system? You know, it's an electrical, electrochemical reaction, a spark that transmits through our nerves in our body up to our brain. Well, what we're talking on right now is our interest, our anxieties, our excitement about what's going on. Our nervous systems are being extended through the World Wide Web right now as you and I speak. And while you and I are speaking right now, hundreds of millions of our fellow human beings are emailing, blogging, complaining, tweeting, right? In other words, 5.5 billion of us are connected by this World Wide Web, and these nervous systems are all coursing through coaxial cables, traveling underneath oceans, over mountains, up to satellites, being beamed in again, creating this circuitry of nervous energy, which if we play it right, and it's going to be complex and it's going to be a very exciting and sometimes dangerous ride, but if we do this right, we will learn to collaborate at a level never before seen. And as Yuval Noah Harari points out, it is our ability to collaborate that has brought us to the point where we are as the most intelligent species on the planet. But on the other side, those who prefer to take the darker side have a point. All this nervous energy may push us over the cliff.
Yeah.
But you don't get a renaissance without an implosion of what was of the things that were holding it back. And that speaks to the materialist paradigm that you and I spoke before. And it is eroding. But you have to look under the noise of the 24/7 news cycle to find the evidence that you and I are talking about. If anyone listening to us or watching us gets so caught up in the 24/7 news cycle, which we need to be aware of, we're so caught up in our own personal anxieties, we not only can't see the forest for the trees, we can't get the signals coming from our unconscious all the time, and we don't have to be experts in the unconscious to receive them. We just have to open up to them and learn their language a little bit. So, and one reason I spend a lot more time on Carl Jung than Sigmund Freud is because while Freud wasn't wrong about the unconscious, he scared the hell out of everybody. Because according to Freud, the unconscious that all of us are born with and live with is a reservoir of dark, angry, explosive emotions having to do with the rage of being born and having to deal with parental control and et cetera. Well, Jung showed that while Freud was not wrong, he was extremely limited. And it was Jung who pointed out to us through a career, not with theory, but by what he experienced working with his clients and working his own dreams and his own meditation, pointed out that the human unconscious is the deepest, most exhilarating source we have for creativity and insight. And it's waiting for us to work with it. That's why we dream 4 to 6 times a night, even if we don't remember them. That's why everyone watching and listening to us has had at least one experience, probably dozens, of where they got an intuitive insight seemingly out of nowhere that changed their lives. So we need to tap more into this aspect of our brains. And it's as you can speak to better than I can, because you've been a professor for decades, we're not taught this. We're taught the materialist paradigm. Here's the information. Take the information. Give it back to me in a way that satisfies what we think is correct. And we'll give you your master's. We'll give you your PhD. And if you really behave yourself, we'll give you tenure. Otherwise, we'll cast you aside.
Yeah.
So, but here's the good news. There is a growing minority of visionary thinkers who are talking the way you and I are talking. And that's what I point out in my book. My book has over 170 footnotes, and we're not alone in this. And I'll give kind of the punchline of my book, because I was trying to figure out, Nicholas, after talking about some very deep themes and proposing that we are being pointed towards a new renaissance, I said, how can I end this? And I remembered a very famous quote by the anthropologist Margaret Mead. And no one to me has said it better and given us a better reason to remain optimistic. She said, and she was a revered anthropologist, never think that a small group of committed citizens can't change the world, because in fact, it's the only thing that ever has.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a majority. It takes a concerted minority, and the timing of nature's intelligence, which we're not in control of, and if they resonate together at the right time in the right way, which I think we're headed towards, suddenly there's going to be things happening. People go, where'd that come from? You know, it's percolating under the surface of the 24/7 news cycle as we're speaking right now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with that. And I seem to remember a quote or a statistic, and I don't remember the author, but it was, in order to make substantial change in the world, so many people think, well, we have to get everyone on board. And the fact is, we don't. It's actually a very small number of people to need to come together and have a new vision to create change. You don't have to get everybody on board. I mean, the more is better, but, you know, and that's, I think, one of the awesome things about the internet. And I see, you know, conferences happening, you know, virtual conferences. And I think that's one of the things that the pandemic helped us with, is people saw the potential and said, well, let's open this up to everybody. So now you don't actually have to physically go to a, you know, seminar series or anything. You can do it from the comfort of your living room. But it also reminds me, one of the early ideas in the internet, and it was often taken from what Tim Leary had said, which was find the others.
Find the others.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of what's happening. But I also want to say that there is chaos in this, and you've mentioned chaos a couple times, but in most ancient mythologies and the creation stories, creation always emerges out of chaos.
And here's, okay, and guess what? Ralph Abraham, a brilliant mathematician, and others have now shown that those creation myths were actually resonating with what we now know as hard science, because the most exciting new science is called systems theory, not a very exciting name. But what system theory has proven is that nature is able to generate what we evolution at the, at its base through chaos. Chaos is not a negative. Chaos simply means an energy source,
right?
Like a fuel, right? So in other words, now I'm not a mechanic. I prove that all the time when I try to change a light bulb and it takes me an hour. But a combustion engine, right? Which we're all familiar with. Combustion. Our cars go because there is a combustion happening, which is a mild explosion, okay? A spark, right? So electricity is about sparks. And so our brains are electrochemical entities. And we get new ideas when there's a spark of an electrochemical signal jumping over a synapse and connecting neurons that weren't connected before. And one of the points I make in my book, quoting people who know a lot more about this than I do, is that the World Wide Web, which connects things through hypertext and search engines, is more analogous to the way a human brain generates new ideas than is the printed page. McLuhan was getting at this. Mm-hmm. McLuhan was a literary professor. He loved books. I still love to read. I'm looking at these amazing books behind you. Books are not going away. But the fact is that the digital screen, for all of its confusion, for all of its addictive qualities, for all of the noise and anger that we have to deal with on it, is closer to the in the way it works through hypertext, through search engines, to the way we generate new ideas in our brains than is the printed page. Let me give an example. I present a lot of thought experiments in my book, The Quantum and the Dream, because if it was good enough for Einstein, it's good enough for us. And Einstein's thought experiments were not about intellect. They were not about IQ. Einstein famously couldn't get a job when he graduated because he was kind of a renegade and he didn't really play by the rules of universities. He discovered relativity by doing thought experiments in his head. He was not in a laboratory or a prestigious university when he discovered relativity. He was sitting at an office desk, imagining what it would be like to chase a light beam. And this is a direct quote, which has been authenticated. He has said that his entire career is based on a dream he had when he was 11 years old. I present the dream in the book and we talk about it. So I'm not suggesting that you, I, or any of your viewers or listeners are going to discover something on the level of relativity by playing with the imagination that our brain allows us to play with and visualize interesting scenarios in our brain and see what happens. But there are examples, I include them in my book, of people who knew very little about dream work or the unconscious, who not only changed their lives by remembering a dream and working it, or by thinking more about how they can be more intuitive, but changed history. So let me give a thought experiment as to why I am so optimistic about the potential of the World Wide Web, given its negative sides as well. Let's say you and I and all of your listeners and viewers decided as a group that we wanted to learn more about Saturn's rings. But as part of the thought experiment, none of us have ever been to a library before. So all of us, we head off to a library and we pick you as our leader. And you go up to the librarian and say, my group here would like to learn more about Saturn's rings. How do we do that? Well, the librarian's probably going to say, oh, go to our science section. Within the science section, you'll find an astronomy section. Within the astronomy section, you'll find books on Saturn, and there you'll find information about Saturn's rings. Beautiful. That's because of the Dewey Decimal System we learned about in school, which is a perfect left hemisphere, logical, sequential, print-oriented method of organization. That's brilliant. Here's the limitation. Now, the same group, your viewers, your listeners, we go back to the library, but this time we want to learn whether there have ever been any advertising campaigns based on the Buddha. And now you ask the librarian, what is he or she going to say to you when you say, where do we find a book or books about Buddhist advertising campaigns? Okay. Well, I mean, a confused look on his or her face. And then the best they could say is, well, if you go to our religion section, within that we have a Buddhist section, okay? Even though Buddhism isn't a religion, that's a whole nother story. It's classified that way. And I guess within the Buddhist section, you'll have to take out books and look in the index of each book to see if they mention advertising. Well, that's a pretty time-consuming process. And if we didn't find it in one library, we'd have to transport ourselves to another library, and we probably wouldn't find anything. As I created this thought experiment, I typed into my search engine Buddhist advertising campaigns, and within 5 seconds, I was taken to a website about a sugarless soda called the Thirsty Buddha that used Buddhist insights to advertise it. Okay, it uses coconut water instead of sugar. 5 seconds. There to me is a perfect example, if we take advantage of it, as to the World Wide Web versus the printed book. And again, we still love to read, but we can't be ignorant of the potential of what's being put in front of us and how it can generate new ideas and new insights.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I do, though, want to kind of circle back. And this is my own, you know, experience in terms of teaching, because you do address that in the book and you talk about this sort of epiphany that you had seeing your old elementary school. And being someone who's been teaching for 20 years now, it's becoming increasingly frustrating for me. And one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast and other things is to try to find different avenues for teaching and for sharing information and for having conversations. But what I see happening a lot is, you know, well, a couple of things. One, I think you're right. We're still caught in a materialist paradigm of sorts. I get to kind of skirt around that since I teach philosophy and religious studies and I can bring in these other things. But I often have the sense of that I'm just training students to participate in an ecocidal system and that there has to be something else. So I'm constantly asking this question of, well, what is education? What should it be? How should it look like? And one of the things that I catch a lot is, number one, students are increasingly just typing in things to AI and copying and pasting their responses. And that's not them thinking. That's kind of academic dishonesty. There are ways to use AI, I think. But also, there's this sense of students will just look up something, you know, like on Wikipedia, do the internet search, and think that they know something. And then I want to ask the question of, but do they? Is that what knowledge is? Because this is going to bring us to other, you know, kind of bigger questions as we move forward in this new renaissance. What is education going to look like? What does it mean for us to have knowledge and to translate that into the world?
Okay. So I get pretty adamant about this question, because I went what was considered a very good public school system, and it was, for the most part, stultifying.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with this. Let's say you give an assignment to the students. I want you to write a 20-page paper on the Italian Renaissance and why it was so important.
Mm-hmm.
A student could go on ChatGPT or Claude or any of these new chatbots, and in 10 seconds, right, could have a 25-page essay on the Italian Renaissance and why it was so important historically. That with very little changes, very few changes, you probably couldn't tell was done by AI. The student would have to be smart enough to know that AI tends to repeat things a certain way. I kind of can figure out how it's only going to get better. Okay. But here's my point. To me, this is the fault of the teaching, not the technology. And I'll give you an example. I want your opinion. Mm. Let's say instead of saying, write me a 25-page paper on the Italian Renaissance and why it was important historically, you said, write me a 25-page paper on the Italian Renaissance and which part of that Renaissance was most important to you, and why do you say that? The chatbot can't do that. If you ask the chatbot that question, it would say, I can't tell you what you think is the most important thing. So the advantage of the chatbot is, this gets into left hemisphere, right hemisphere. So let's say the student says, all right, I can have a 25-page paper on the highlights and importance of the Italian Renaissance in less than a minute. Print it out. Now I'm going to take that information, but I have to now make it my own. I have to say, and you can even add to it by saying, you could say, for an example, and I want you to, let's say you were studying the Italian Renaissance and you were studying the philosophy of the humanist philosophy. And you said, write me a 25-page paper on the Italian Renaissance, why it was important. Pick out one or two of the philosophical insights from humanism that you feel are most important and relevant to today in the 21st century, and write it in the style of of your favorite humanist philosopher. Okay. Now, AI will certainly shortcut that, but I say that's good, because what AI is doing, it's taking over the chore of what we call working memory, mm-hmm. which is what my educational system was based on. Memorize this and feed it back to me, especially grades 1 through high school.
Yeah.
Occasionally you get a teacher who's in high school who will make it more personal. But first grade through high school is basically read this, which was a limited view of history, right? Read this and regurgitate back to me what I want you to have learned from it. Okay. But that's what AI is doing. So AI is doing what our educational system is doing, because our educational system is failing us. And here's the reason I can say that. The word education has an inherent meaning. It has an etymology. The word education comes from the Latin educare, which means to draw out. Our educational system, for the most part, not your classes, but for the most part, is to stuff in. Okay, repeat back to me what I want to hear or what I think is right. Okay, if I was teaching a philosophy class, I would say, okay, I want you to write a paper and I want you to come up with a conclusion, whether you believe in it or not, that's different from any philosopher you've ever read. I want you to go out on a limb. I want you to be as outrageous and as inventive as you can be. I'm not interested in whether you're right or not. The chatbot can't do that. So it's our job to shift our educational system from the materialist paradigm. The materialist paradigm is, here's the material, memorize it, and feed it back to us in a way that we say is the right way to feed it back. Instead of educare, to draw out. Now let's throw in what we call ourselves, Homo sapiens. Technically, we're not Homo sapiens. We're Homo sapiens sapiens. Look it up. Okay. Yep. We had to add a sapiens. The word sapiens means wise. So we have called ourselves, right? So we human beings, we labeled every animal, every plant, every insect on the planet. We gave it a name, right? And we called ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens. That means the wise one. So if educare means to draw out, and we're claiming we're the wise ones, then our educational system has to draw out the inherent wisdom in us. Mm-hmm. And I would say the World Wide Web has a better chance of doing that than our educational system, the way it's structured right now.
Yeah.
And for those who say, but wait a minute, Mr. Grunther, what about all these kids who are addicted to social media? What about all the bad actors who are stealing identities and bullying? And I would say those are real problems we have to address. But they've always been there. Bullying has been there. False advertising has been around. I give a great example in my book. The first great PR specialist in this country was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. He knew the unconscious. Edward Bernays. And his most successful campaign was working with the American Tobacco Company in the 1930s to get women to smoke more outdoors because they thought it didn't look right. And he did his big campaign to encourage women to smoke outdoors because that meant you were a free woman.
Mm-hmm. While Liberty you were killing torches. Yourself
with cancer. Okay. there was no internet back then. There wasn't even TV back then. So yes, there are bad actors and there are serious issues with the World Wide Web we need to address. But here's my analogy. Nicholas, you've spent time doing some form of contemplation, right? Where you sit quietly and tune in. Yes. I think most of it, whether some want it to be a formal meditation, some I like more informal contemplation. Question. The first way I learned about the right hemisphere of our brain, the more imaginative, intuitive part of our brain, is I took a course in self-hypnosis. I did it because I thought it'd be fun to hypnotize people at a party. Okay. It blew my mind. Okay. What is the first thing that any of us encounter when we sit down to contemplate or meditate? The noisy, chattering monkey mind that's telling us what we haven't accomplished or nervous about, right? Everybody has confirmed that. So what is the process of meditation and contemplation about? Learning how to get underneath all the noise of our individual brain noise to the deeper contemplative level beneath it, right? Why should we expect when we go on a digital screen, such as you and I are talking on, with 5.5 billion of us connected, why would we expect that to be a quiet, well-organized, comforting place to be? It's going to be every bit as noisy as our own brains are until we learn to get underneath the noise to the deep wisdom that all of us have within us. The same is true for the World Wide Web. The insights that I got from using the World Wide Web for my book, I mean, some of my insights come from books. Some of them came from working the World Wide Web, but I had to get underneath all the noise to find it. So as new as the World Wide Web is, we've been here before, we've been successful before. We got through it, we created a renaissance during a black plague. and we can do it again, but it's going to take a concentrated minority of committed citizens willing to get underneath the noise of our individual brains as well as the cultural brains and collaborate with each other on the insights we get when we get underneath all that noise. That's what my book's about. That's what your teaching's about. And we've never had more access to this than right now with the World Wide Web.
Yeah. Yeah. I would not want to live without the World Wide Web. You know, I'm so used to it now, and it is so incredibly valuable. And when I was doing my research and my master's degree, sort of the conclusion I came up with, or the question I was asking was, you know, McLuhan had this idea that, you know, we create our tools and then our tools create us. And I was curious about, well, if that's so, how is the internet going to change us? How is it going to make us, you know, change our consciousness in a sense? And at the time, the closest parallel that I could find was in religious traditions was the kind of the New Age movement and some of the ideas within that, because they do borrow from the, you know, Eastern traditions. I would change all of that now in, you know, 25 years later and looking back, that I would actually say that the way it's changing our consciousness is it is making us more ecological in the sense of recognizing interconnections between ideas, interconnections between people and communities and nature and the whole shebang.
And I think that McLuhan would agree with you. And I got lucky. I believe it was more synchronicity than luck. When I did a project in the 90s, I found a quote in Rolling Stone magazine, rock magazine. It was talking about the job market in the 21st century. This is back in the 90s. And the opening quote was this really provocative quote saying, jobs in the 21st century, there aren't going to be any jobs. There are only going to be roles to play. And it was from an executive of the Marshall McLuhan Foundation, who I immediately contacted and got friendly with. And every Friday for a year, he would call me and we would spend 2 hours talking about McLuhan. And he would send me books and papers of McLuhan's that weren't published. So I had a big advantage there. He was a visionary. And what made him interesting is he wasn't interested in being right.
Right.
He was interesting in provoking us to go deeper into our insight capability. And he taught us. He was such a trickster because he loved books. He taught us more about TV than anybody. And when he was asked, how much TV do you watch? He said, as little as necessary.
Right.
But he understood you can't, in the 1960s, that incredible revolutionary time, women's movement, civil rights movement, anti-war movement, wouldn't have happened without television. It wouldn't have happened. Because he pointed out, it's not about the content on TV.
Right.
It's the process and the way it works with the brain. We think when we were watching TV, we were watching an image on a screen. He pointed out, and it's been proven, no, we weren't. A TV set sends electrodes into the brain, which our brain then unconsciously creates into a picture. The picture isn't on the screen, it's in our brain. And that affects the way we think about the world. And I agree with you, for all the crap that's on the World Wide Web, of course there's going to be a lot of crap. 5.5 billion people are pouring stuff onto it. Okay? Most of the books that are published aren't particularly that, you know, edifying. Most of the TV programs weren't edifying. That's not the point. The point is the process. And the fact that we are kicking and screaming, forcing ourselves to become more collaborative, is at the same time, this is why Zen masters give, you know, they give you puzzles, koans, that are ridiculous to solve because they require intuition, not rational thought. The rational brain says, wait a minute, how can we become more collaborative at a time when political parties can't even talk to each other? When there's more noise than ever, more anger than ever? The answer is, in my opinion, the anger and anxiety that's being ramped up is a unconscious reaction to the fact that things are changing so fast. And when the human brain can't deal with change, it's called cognitive dissonance, it will immediately convince itself that if we could only go back in time when things were better.
Right.
Things weren't better back then. They were maybe, they were, change wasn't happening as fast. Oh, the good old days. Oh, when you mean there were no civil rights? The good old days when there were virtually no women in positions of power? Those good old days? So yeah, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of chaos. This is nature's way of telling us humans, you're going to have to make a leap in consciousness, in insight. It's time. It's happened before in history. It's time. It's not going to be comfortable. It's not going to be rational. We're not going to be able to predict where we're going. One of the key elements of quantum theory is the uncertainty principle. Without uncertainty, let me ask this question. If everything was certain, there'd be no interesting art, no interesting music, no interesting philosophy. Part of the reason we are who we are is because of our need to deal with uncertainty. Without the false comfort of thinking everything's now certain.
Right.
And so, yes, it's a very challenging time for us. We're all anxious. McLuhan said, we've now extended the human nervous system throughout the entire planet. We've created this whole nervous system. And those of us who are more, let's say, mystically, spiritually inclined, think it's like Teilhard de Chardin, the great mystic thinker, who talked about a noosphere, that there was, he talked about in the 20s and 30s, that there was a circuit being created around the planet of spiritual wisdom. Okay, he was probably right. But along with that comes a lot of noise and a lot of bad actors.
Yeah.
And our job is to be able to deal with all the noise and get to the, I would say, spiritual, intuitive, imaginative, new ways of looking at our connection to nature that are absolutely now required. Otherwise, I don't think nature's angry with us. Nature's doing what she always does. She reacts and she teaches. And I believe the World Wide Web is a reflection of the collective unconscious, a Jungian term, that's a signal to us. I think AI is a signal to us saying, okay, humans, you thought you were so smart. You created a tool, AI. You created it. It's already smarter than you at finding information, analyzing it, and putting that analysis together. It's already better than you at that. It's your job to find the part of your brain that's complementary to that, which is the intuitive part. Computers aren't intuitive. Computers can imitate empathy, but they're not empathic because they can't feel. They're not sentient. That's our job. We have to deal with the messy emotions of being human. Computers don't. So we need to collaborate with AI and find out what part of the brain we need to access. And my book gets into this. Mm-hmm. It's the right hemisphere, which, by the way, is geographically larger than the left hemisphere and more intricately wired. What does that tell us? It's time to access it. And that's what the story of my book is about. And again, so reasons for optimism. We could list 100 reasons to be pessimistic, and they'd be good reasons. So let me give 2 reasons to be optimistic. The World Wide Web that we're talking about was created by one person, just as the theory of relativity was discovered by one person. Usually it's a collaborative effort. Okay. His name was Tim Berners-Lee. He created it in 1990 at the underground laboratory at CERN in Switzerland. Why did he create it? Because he was frustrated that all the scientists from different countries working at this incredible underground laboratory couldn't communicate, their computers couldn't talk to each other. We had an internet, but the computers couldn't connect with each other and pass along information. So He went to his director and said, I'd like to work on creating a prototype so our computers can work so we can talk to each other through them. The director said, okay. He did it. He created the protocols for now we now know as the World Wide Web. When he brought it to his director, these are two pretty smart people, right? They knew what they had. They knew if they monetized it, right? If they had monetized what he found in 1990, they would make Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Zuckerberg look like paupers. But they both agreed this was too important to be monetized by two individuals. This needs to be given to humanity. This needs to be open sourced, not privately owned. Now, since then, the Bezoses, the Gateses, the Zuckerbergs have said, no, we want to own it and we want to control it. We want to make as much money we can out of it. Materialist paradigm. Okay. But the guy who invented it wasn't. And by the way, he's not retired. He's at MIT working on ways to make the World Wide Web even more open sourced. So there's one reason to be optimistic. It took one human being and his director to make a decision that knowledge needs to be given away. Guess what? The internet, which is the hardware, the which was created in the late 1960s. You know who created it? A collaboration between the military and some intellects. Mm-hmm. When does the military give something away to humanity? But they did, because they said this is too important not to give to universities. So there's a reason to be optimistic. The second reason comes from William Irwin Thompson, the great cultural historian, who pointed out in the 70s and 80s, he's been proven to be right, the advantage to things changing as fast as they are. We know it creates a lot of anxiety and problems. Kevin Kelly, the co-founder of Wired Magazine, the great magazine of the digital age, you know who their patron saint was? Marshall McLuhan. Yeah. Okay. Kevin Kelly famously said, things are morphing so fast, we don't even have a chance to civilize them. Okay. But William Irwin Thompson pointed out, the other side of that is, things are changing so fast that one individual or small groups of individuals in a short amount of time can create the kind of change that would have taken decades or centuries to create in the past. So there's two reasons to be optimistic. I give a few more in my book.
Yeah. Well, I like the idea of, it seems what's needed is imagination. And the way I think, I know we're starting to run out of time because I've got to go and teach a class. Unfortunately, I could talk to you quite a bit longer. But kind of circling back to my experience with teaching, is the students already come in with that materialist mindset there. And especially in the United States, where everything is predicated on testing. So it always frustrated me, because what they wanted to know was, well, what are the questions that are going to be on the test so they could just memorize the answers? And that was always very difficult for me. And I have contemplated our educational system in a variety of ways. And this was something that was they attempted to instill in me. I remember the example that you gave of the kinds of questions that you could ask someone to be sort of creative in their answers. I remember when I was a community college student, I took a humanities class, and we had this essay prompt of, if you were to choose one work of art that was reflective of the Renaissance, what would it be and why? And what I did is I took that prompt, and the way it was worded is that you're the director of the Renaissance Museum kind of in the future, and because of lack of funding, you have to get rid of everything. So what's the one piece of art that you would save and why? So I wrote a short story where I had the person in charge of the museum had actually sold everything or found places for it, because they were going to close it down. And he was just flipping through this book, kind of ruminating on various things, you know, pieces of art. And I thought, well, that's the Renaissance mindset, is I'm going to save this art and not necessarily focus just on one. And I got an F on it. And the instructor's like, you're confusing talent with knowledge.
Well, I would have flunked your professor.
Yeah. Well, she was actually military, so there's that. But I've reflected on all this, and it seems to me that what has to be done now is not necessarily changing the system that we have, because I don't know that we can. I think that what has to happen now is to create things that will replace it. So instead of changing everything from the ground up, just start something that's going to replace what isn't working.
Well, I would say because I'm not in education, I can't give specific principles on how to change the system. What I would point out is what McLuhan pointed out. Our educational system is in the process of imploding because of nature's power. Why do I say that? At some point, people are going to say, why am I spending $50,000, $80,000 a year sending my kid to a college when they can get a great education at a community college? I think what's going to happen is you're going to start to see, I call them pods develop, where parents, students, tutors band together and create educational environments that include reading books, but also include being on the World Wide Web so you can have conversations with people in other countries, right? And have people access the World Wide Web as well as books that they're given. There will not be a board of education sitting there going, this is what you have to learn. It'll be much more open sourced. I go back to that phrase because it's so powerful. And why Tim Berners-Lee is a great modern American, excuse me, planetary hero. He gave us the World Wide Web. He gave it to us. He's not alone. There are others who are less interested in owning things and manipulating them for the grossest profit, right? And more interested in, yeah, I want to make enough money so I can enjoy life and support my family, given, but I also want to give back. I want to give this to humanity. And the military did it in the late 60s. They gave the internet to universities for research, and that ended up in our laps. So this is an example, and it was the most exciting research I did for my book, The Quantum and the Dream. This is the research of Lynn Margulis, who proved, despite being a woman in the 1960s, getting her PhD in a very patriarchal educational system. They called her the Angry Earth Mother because she wouldn't take crap from anybody. And she loved men. Her first marriage was to Carl Sagan as a teenager. They divorced, but her son and her collaborated the rest of her life, Dorian Sagan. And what Lynn Margulis proved is that at the microbial level, millions of years ago, through a process we now know as self-organization, a feedback loop, because microbes don't have brains. They figured out photosynthesis, the most important technology ever invented on this planet, a greater technology than any human has ever invented. Without photosynthesis, we wouldn't have plants, we wouldn't have animals, we wouldn't have us. And photosynthesis was discovered, absorbed, however, by microbes. Why? Because on the surface, microbes are predators. They're eating each other, they're defending their territory, just like we see in nature, right? But underneath that, Lynn Margulis found, because she had an intuition it was there, she proved it was there. Underneath all the eat or be eaten, defend your territory, expand your territory, even if it means killing others. Underneath all that, through a feedback system, microbes learned that by collaborating, they could do better. And it was through this collaboration. Now, it took millions of years, right? But now, things that took microbes millions of years, we can do in years. Okay? We're part of nature, whether we know it or not. We're born out of nature's intelligence, evolution. I have a formula in my book. HI, which is human intelligence, over AI, which is computer intelligence, and they're in the parentheses. To the left of parentheses, in much larger font, is NI, nature's intelligence. At the other side is an equals new renaissance. And the arrow is a spiral. And what I'm getting at is, if we can do it right, and I think we can, we're going to take the deeper part of human brain, which is not the analytical rational part, but the intuitive imaginal part. We're going to work that with AI's amazing capacity at analyzing and retrieving information. And then we're going to figure out how to take that combination and apply it to nature's intelligence, which is always pulling us towards more, towards newer, more complex forms of collaboration. That's not a theory. That's not a guess. That's been proven scientifically. That doesn't mean that we won't steer evolution off the cliff for humans, because we have the ability to steer us off the cliffs. But if you look at the pull of evolution, it's towards more new, more complex forms of collaboration. Right. And I think that that instinct, that deep intuition, is going to win out in the end. No guarantees, but that's my proposal.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I kind of circled back to education, because I saw that as just one model that with more collaboration, I think we are going to be creating something new, not necessarily restructuring what already is. I mean, in some aspects, yes, we will. But, you know, with the bubonic plague, things fell apart and we had to build up new structures. And I think that with climate change, the same thing's going to happen. And I think we're going to recognize that the structures we have, be it education, corporate, you know, capitalism, what have you, that we're going to have to come together, be creative to create this new world. And that is, I think, the renaissance that you're talking about.
And the key, what I get from what you're saying, which I agree with underneath what you're saying, is that to get to a renaissance, we have to deal both with the best of who we are and the worst of who we are, yeah. The darkness. Okay. That's why I love working and playing with the unconscious, which mm-hmm. is what the right hemisphere of our brain is capable of doing. Because what we perceive as darkness, yes, it's scary and it's uncertain, and it's ambiguous. It's chaotic. I believe Carl Jung was 100% correct, and he wasn't alone. It's the deep, dark, unconscious realm where most of our deepest creativity lies. And we don't have to become experts in psychology or psychoanalysis to tap into it. In my book, The Quantum and the Dream, I give simple ways that we can start tapping more into this creative source underneath the level of consciousness. And I challenge any of your viewers to prove me wrong on this. Go to a bookstore or library and take out all these books on consciousness that are brilliant, and go to the index and look up the unconscious. In most of those books, you won't find it. To talk about consciousness without the unconscious is like thinking that we can understand ocean currents by watching waves crash on a beach. No, we can't. The waves are great, but they are a result of what's going underneath the surface of the ocean. Who we are, every psychologist agrees with this, virtually every psychologist, who we are is much more our unconscious than our conscious. You'd think our educational system would want to maybe educate us a little bit more about that. Well, we can do it on our own. It doesn't take years. It doesn't take, you know, I got certified in dream work because I find it fascinating. But I have an example in my book. Elias Howe literally launched the Industrial Revolution based on a horrific nightmare he had, and he was not a dream expert. But he tapped into that dream. It's available to all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's time to dream a better future for ourselves, I think.
good place to start.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a good place to end. I do have to run to a class in a different city. But let me ask you quickly, what do you have coming up next? What are you working on next?
Well, I'm living up to the principle of my book because, well, I have some ideas on what's next. My ideas are conscious. I want to see where the book takes me. The book was published October 1st, so it's still new. I appreciate having time on really invigorating, stimulating podcasts like yours. And I want to keep the door open to where the book wants to take me. Maybe it's a podcast, maybe it's writing essays, maybe it's creating a different radio show. I don't know yet.
Yeah.
But I'm encouraged by the response so far, and it's exciting to have the book out there, and I want to see where it takes me.
All right. Wonderful. Wonderful. And is there a place where people can go to find out more about you and the book? And
right now, my website, douglasgrunther.com, is a landing page for my book with more information about my book. The book is available on Amazon or can be ordered at any bookstore. I do have a radio show Sunday mornings on Radio Woodstock. I'm now in my 44th year. That's radiowoodstock.com. It's an FM licensed radio station out of Woodstock, but broadcast out. And, you know, I'm going to continue doing my part to try to induce the new renaissance. I believe it's there for us. And having conversations with people like you encourages me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that that's what we have to do. We have to have these conversations. And, you know, I remain hopeful. I remain hopeful, and I know that you do too. So what I will do is I'll put the link for your website and the book and the Radio Woodstock in the show notes and the video description so people can more easily find you and your work. So Douglas, thank you so much for the time this morning. I do wish we had more time. There's a lot more I would love to talk to you about, but I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
Well, I did too, and I appreciate the invitation and hope our paths cross in the future.
Yeah, I do too as well. I do too as well. All right. Well, thank you. And that's a wrap on episode 171 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. I'm pretty sure you all know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon. Share this with friends and family and on social media too, please. Subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know you know the drill, but the thing is, all that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following, these are all free and they only take a few seconds of your time and they really do help. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love and I do love it. As you know, I'm in the process of making some changes to the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.